So the chant will start off with to raise the energy, to get us into a more energetic and meditational state. We'll start off with something by the name of Hari Om. Hari Om. It's a little piece of mantra yoga. It's not just a chant. And when I say mantra yoga, the difference between a chant and mantra yoga is that there's a little bit of a visualization comes into this. And the visualization is only there so that you can start to get in touch more and more with the energies that reside deep inside you. So, for example, when you chant Ha, which is the first part of Hari Om, try and make that Ha reverberate at the base of your spine, in the base chakra. And because we're talking tonight a little bit about grounding negative energies, which are absolutely essential for anybody who is at all sensitive, because in spiritual life we grow very sensitive to energies and everything else in this beautiful universe of ours. But also, together with that sensitivity, we need to become strong, because sensitivity without strength means that you can die very easily. Grounding is part of that strength which is needed by every sensitive person, and it is the fundamental, the grounding of meditation also. So when I say Ha, it's not because I'm laughing, it's because I am allowing that Ha to reverberate right down at the base of my spine. And I'm going to make it reverberate, and I'm going to make it connect me with the earth, the fundamental of our being, Mother Earth. Remember Mother Earth, we must take care of her, says the Native American Indian tradition. If you read the Gospel of Peace of Jesus Christ, you'll find out on page 60. He says, "And after this manner, pray to your earthly mother." This is Jesus Christ. This is the other Lord's Prayer. And he says what the original Lord's Prayer is. Heavenly Father, our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. And the prayer to our earthly mother. Our mother, which art upon earth, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, and thy will be done in us as it is in thee. As thou sendest every day the angels, send them to us also. Forgive us our sins, as we atone all our sins against thee. And lead us not into sickness, but deliver us from all evil. For thine is the earth, the body, and the health. Amen. And Jesus Christ says that once we know the law of the earth, once we follow the law of the earth, then we can never be sick. It is only when we are taken away from that natural law that we start to become egotistical. We start to become sick, and we eventually die before our time. with a great wailing and gnashing of teeth, I may add. But it's true enough. If we don't know what we're doing, if we eat the wrong things, if we do not know, we can very easily stray from the straight and narrow. So when I say ha, a great deal is included. And I want you to visualize that ha is reverberating at the base of your spine. And when I move into ri, move that energy from the base of the spine up into the throat. Ha, ri. And then om, a sacred word of the Hindus. I always feel a bit shaky about saying sacred, because really, for anything to be sacred, we have to put our feeling into it. As Swami Satchidananda said to me one day, you must put into everything your bhavana, your feeling, your will, your energy, and only then is it sacred. And this is why in Hindu temples they bring anything into the temple and say this is an offering to God. And when it is offered to God with feeling and with bhavana, then it becomes sacred. So again, with Om, we have a sacred word. But in a way, this sacred word is a little bit like Jacob's ladder. It is a channel twixt heaven and earth, as it says in the scriptures. So when I say Om, I mean three sacred syllables of A, U, and M. And when you chant Aum, A, U, and M, I want you to visualize that the sound is starting off in the base chakra again. So the R reverberates at the base of your spine, connecting you with the earth. U, move the energy up into your heart, but still keep that vibration at the base of your spine. And M, make it vibrate in your nasal cavity to start with. And then as you get further into the M, start to make it reverberate in the third eye, in your forehead. And then as it goes on, I want you to take it right up to the crown chakra. And as your breath fails you, I want you to take it up into the air as high as you can, all the time, keeping in contact with the earth. So when we chant Hari Om, I will chant the first line, and then you can chant it afterwards. Sort of like there's a response. That's the way we'll do it to start with, just in case there's anybody who doesn't know how to chant Hari Om. So there we go. So with a little more ado, if you can sit up straight, because it really does make a difference if you can have a straight spine. I know it's a bit difficult for you sitting in those cockpits, but if you can try, it's good to have a straight spine.
Hari Om, Hari Om, Hari 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 Om.
Hari Om, Hari Om, Hari 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 Om.
Hari Om, Hari Om, Hari Hari Om.
Hari Om, Hari Om, Hari Hari Om.
Hari Om, Hari Om, Hari 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 Om.
Hari 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 Om.
Hari 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 Hari
Om.
Hari 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 Om.
Hari 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 Om.
Hari 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 Om.
Hari 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 Om.
Hari 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 Hari
Hari Om, Hari Om,
Hari Om, Hari 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 Om.
Hari
one day, as it would, was a guy by the name of Alexander. And because he was an egotistical little sod, he called himself Alexander the Great. And he was only 20-odd. And he was sort of preparing to conquer all of the known world at that time. And he had heard of this beautiful, enlightened being by the name of Diogenes. Now everybody knows that Diogenes lived in a tub. Have you heard that at school? When you were at school, there was this guy by the name of Diogenes and he lived in a tub in Greece. No? That's what I heard when I was at school. That's all I ever knew about Diogenes. Well, Diogenes was one of these beautiful enlightened Buddhas, an enlightened being. And he was a bit strange. He was a beautiful, well-formed man, glowing with health and vitality. And he used to walk around naked, no clothes on. How do you think, in those days, the Greeks didn't mind that sort of thing. Everybody used to do it, you know. Everybody wore clothes, but Diogenes didn't. He used to walk around, either, you know, not that. Couldn't do it in Britain very well, but Greece is a different matter. And Alexander had heard that Diogenes was quite a wise soul. And being an inquisitive young man, and a very capable and intelligent young man, as a matter of fact, a very talented young man, he decided he wanted to go and see this fellow by the name of Diogenes. And together with his armed guard, there's a story about Alexander one day, and he was fixing the picture on the wall, and it's that picture behind you there. He was sort of reaching up, because he wasn't very tall, Alexander, actually. He was very beautiful and very well formed, but he was a bit short. And his armed guard were all 7 feet tall. And the armed guard said to him, "My lord, let me sort the picture out for you. I'm bigger than you are." And Alexander got really stroppy. He said, "Ha! You're not bigger than me. You might be taller than me, but you're never bigger than me." So there he is. He's wandering about town, and there's these 7 8-foot-6 guys with big swords wandering around with him. Because, you know, then as like now, the life of a politician is fraught with danger. And he asks the town people, "Where is this wise god, naked, glowing with health?" And they say, "Oh, Diogenes, he's over by the river. You can usually find him over there at this time of the day. He's sunning himself." And he walks over towards the river with his armed guard, and he sees Diogenes lying, stretched out in utter bliss in the sunshine. And he says to his armed guard, "Excuse me, my men, but I don't think you'll be necessary for the time being." And the captain of the guard said, "Sir, please don't go," he said. "My job is to protect you. If you die, the king will have my guts for garters." But Alexander's a bit of a stern, lordly young man. He says, "No, you must stay. I want to talk with Diogenes alone. Just take me, my lord. I have my strong sword to protect you. He'll not get near you. No, you just stay there." So 100 yards away, he leaves the armed cohort, and he strolls over, chum, 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 armor jingling against the stones, over to where Diogenes is lying on the ground, sunning himself. And Alexander says to Diogenes, "I hear that you're a very wise man." And Diogenes says, "Yeah, I have that reputation. What can I do for you, master?" And Alexander says, "Well," he says, "I would like something from you. But," he says, "tell me, I'm thinking of going to conquer all the known world." And Diogenes says, "Well," he says, "after you've done that, what will you do?" And Alexander says, "Well, I've never thought of that before." He says, "I suppose I'll just come and sit by the river, just like you." So Diogenes says, "Well, why bother with all this ructions and thrashings and killing people and raping and pillaging all over the world?" He says, "Why don't you just give that up now and just come and sit down here with me now, instead of all that?" And young Alexander's a little bit taken aback. He says, well, I've set my mind on this. I'm going to go and take over the world. You know, most of you men are a bit like this. They seem to want to do things. Diogenes says to Alexander, well, he says, if you're not going to come and sit here with me, he says, can you just move out of the sunlight a little bit? Your shadow is spoiling my sunning myself. So Alexander just moves over a little bit, sort of mumbles a little bit, and he sort of just walks off back to his cohorts, and he goes off. And of course, as we well know, he goes over and takes over all the known world. And just as Alexander was dying in India, and it's a very well-known fact that Alexander caught a fever at the age of 35, and he died, just like that. And he knew he was going to die the next day. And all of his servants were there, and all of his generals were there, and they were saying, my lord, please don't die. And he says, well, what can I do? It's the will of the Lord. He's a very well together young man, this, but he couldn't help thinking about Diogenes. And he says, I never did have the chance to sit by the river. Perhaps I'll do that next time round. And he says, I'll tell you what, when you take me on my funeral procession through the town tomorrow in my coffin, he says, I want you to have my hands outside the coffin with the palms facing up towards the sky, and I want you to screw down the coffin lid so all people can see are my hands. And my lord, why do you want us to do this? He says, well, I want people to know that I came into this world with nothing, and I'm taking nothing out of it. And every week, as he plundered and pillaged the cities of Asia, his servants were running back to Greece with ass after ass, loaded with gold, silver, jewels, and diamonds. He says, I'm taking nothing with me. And he couldn't help thinking that perhaps he would have been a little bit better sitting by the side of the river in the sun with good old Diogenes, a very wise man. And as an introduction to the base chakra, that is nothing like death. Death is the last fear to leave a human being before they become enlightened. It's the last one to go. The process of enlightenment is, first of all, from energy moving from the solar plexus into the heart, the first trans-egotistical chakra. It's the chakra that takes you out of love and hate. It takes you out of the world of duality. If you've got duality as the lower side of the triangle, the peak of that triangle is the heart. If you say you love another person, in the world of duality, that can immediately flip over into hate. As a matter of fact, you can't hate a person unless you've had some love for them too. In the world of life and death, of duality, there's a higher stage. It's like the electron in the shells of an atom. And in order for an electron to raise its energy into the next higher stage, it has to be hit by a photon. It's called a quantum leap. And when that electron is hit by a photon, it gets a lot of energy. And that electron is immediately raised to a higher energy, into a higher subshell of the atom. And sometimes it drops back. And when it drops back, it gives out the same photon of energy. And this is the way that lasers are created. They pump the ruby full of light. And then all the atoms release the photon at the same time, and a coherent beam of energy is created. So a quantum leap for a human being, the first stage, is called the opening of the heart. And in that state of openness of the heart, it's like you've been given another function. Most people think that human beings are just composed of the intellect. Most people can just use their minds and they can do things. But the quantum leap for the mind is to create another mind space, which is called the space of the heart, the space of unselfishness, the space of compassion, the space that actually feels for other people, instead of being locked in the moaning, poor me, ill human syndrome. In order for us to move up into the heart, we need to have healed ourselves a little bit. And if we don't heal ourselves and we don't open the heart, then the next stage is to become a tyrant. All those people you see who are completely well and haven't opened the heart, they're running around grabbing things for themselves. And you see people like Hitler, a very evolved young man, and he's trying to maintain his position. He's trying to stay the king of the castle before all of his rivals push him off. So he goes around shooting all of his rivals. And if anybody says anything against him, off to the concentration camps. And you can see what Stalin did over in Russia. Killed 20 million Russians and they went off to the gulags in their droves. And you can see Pol Pot in the killing fields of Cambodia. 4 million of the highly educated upper class killed. And Mao Tse-tung, again, worried about his position, started a story about the capitalist rodents who were his rivals. And all the young people naively believed him and killed them all. So the base chakra is the earth chakra. It's the chakra which connects you with the earth. And the base chakra is the living law of the earth. And if we listen to the base chakra, if we follow the rules of the base chakra, if we look after the base chakra, then we can live long and happy lives. If we do not connect with the base chakra, then we will be ungrounded. We will not listen to our deep, basic nature. We will eat anything that comes our way, and we will suffer the consequences. Because the base chakra is the chakra of security. And have you ever heard of those people who are called comfort eaters? You know, the base chakra is the chakra of food. Wonderful stuff. And if your security is threatened in any way, then it's the base chakra where that is felt. Any sort of insecurity, and the base chakra is hit, it's punched, it's rocked. And that can have all sorts of effects on a human being. the security of food. If you don't have enough food, you might die. The security of housing. If you lose your house and your shelter against the elements, you might die. If you lose your job and your money, you might die. You know, when those millionaires in the 1932 Wall Street crash found out they lost everything, a few of them jumped from the top of the Empire State Building. And when the names of Lloyds lost a lot of their money, a few of them committed suicide. Because the base chakra had been threatened. So talking about the grounding of negative energies, whenever the base chakra is rocked, whenever the base chakra is hit, whenever we feel insecure, we might reach for the strychnine, we might jump from the Empire State Building, we might reach for the fridge door. But our connection with the earth is utterly destroyed. We go back to heaven. So when I'm talking about the grounding of negative energies, I'm actually talking about connecting with the earth. And if we can connect with the earth, and remember in electricity, we have something called an earth. And what happens if there is a buildup of voltage or electricity? It magically gets earthed, and the danger is taken away. And if we are earthed, if the numbers of our base chakra are normalized, then we have the capacity of earthing the shock which is entered into the base chakra. So this is what I was saying at the beginning. As we become more spiritual, we become more sensitive. And as we become more spiritual, so we need to become strong. Because as you become more sensitive, when you meet a person with a disturbed base chakra who's got a lot of troubles, that trouble, that psychic trouble, will osmotically enter into you. And if you hold on to it, then you will think that you feel insecure, whereas you've just picked up something from somebody else. And all the time we are interacting with other human beings, we are picking up all of their emotional and psychic detritus, because every human being is tremendously sensitive. And the most sensitive members of our race are called enlightened. And they're called enlightened because they can take enormous amounts of negative energy from you. And Satya Sai Baba in India, an enlightened being, said to us when we were out there, he said, "Look, I am the biggest guru in the world," he said, looking down his nose at us. "I am the biggest guru in the world, and I can take away your most deep karmas. And because I am the biggest guru in the world, and can take away the deepest karmas from everybody, only the worst people come to see me." I like that joke. Yes, but it's no good depending upon anybody else to do your job for you. What they say in traditional Chinese acupuncture is get the energies flowing correctly around the body, and this can take a few sessions. And the acupuncturist says, well, you know, you had a problem here and a problem that caused the energies to go out of balance. If you hadn't done that, you'd have been all right. Well, you try going into a doctor's surgery with a cut in your arm and the blood hemorrhaging out of it, and the doctor says, oh, you shouldn't have cut yourself. If you hadn't done that, the blood wouldn't be coming out. You wouldn't be dying. No, the doctor just pats you on the head, gets the needle and thread and sews it up. No problem. Sometimes that's why we need the help of another human being, why we need an acupuncturist, why we need a doctor, why we need an enlightened being. And not only does an enlightened being take away the negativity from some of your chakras, allowing them to normalize themselves, but an enlightened being also charges up your energy centers. And that can enable you to get into a state of meditation a lot more easily than perhaps you could by yourself. But if you become dependent upon any other human being for your enlightenment, then you will soon get disabused of that idea. It is everybody's, every person's destiny to become enlightened. And the only way you can do that is by learning about the laws of the earth and living them within yourself. Not following the graven laws that have been put upon tablets of stone, but actually knowing about those laws inside yourself and automatically, without thinking about it, following them. This is the only way that we can rise. So when somebody says to you, eat organic food, and you say, why? Well, perhaps you have to learn through illness and disease why you should eat organic food. And when Jesus Christ or Moses says, thou shalt not kill, and you say, well, surely he only means human beings. And Jesus Christ says, no, I meant the animals as well. Any living thing thou shalt not kill. And it gets changed down through the ages because it's a bit difficult to follow that one. But if you don't know that the psychic toxins of so much death will enter into your being and create disharmony and create disease, then perhaps you have to eat a few tons of cow before you get mad to find out the truth. You see, we've been given free will. The animals know what to do. They have no free will. They eat the grass. They eat the leaves. If anybody gives them a steak, they go, what's that? No, thank you. But we have a choice. We can do anything we want to do. We can do bad and learn through our mistakes, and we can do good and find out where it takes us. So nobody will insist with you that they are right. They might just give you gentle hints. And then you have to find out whether those gentle hints are correct by following those hints for yourself and finding out for yourself. This is the only way that you can grow. Nobody can tell you, nobody can force you to grow. But they can give little hints and little helps. And through that encouragement and through that inspiration, then perhaps you can grow. I wrote down a few things that I was going to say tonight in here, and I think we're going to have to miss out a little bit. As usual, I burble on. So food is the base chakra. It's the earth. And where does the food come from? It comes from Mother Earth. There's a sort of saying in software engineering and in computers: garbage in, garbage out. Related to food, if you eat the wrong sorts of things, and we did a whole lecture a few weeks back all about food, we are what we eat. And when we take garbage in, then garbage comes out. But Mother Earth is very forgiving. And this garbage that comes out, she thinks of as fertilizer. The earth has a tremendously transmutative effect upon anything which is given to her. As we fertilize the land, so the wheat grows. As we fertilize the trees, so the fruit grows, and the earth gives back beauty from shit. Physically, she transmutes everything. Psychically, she transmutes everything. She is the philosopher's stone. So when we're talking about the first stage of energy work, which is what we teach here, we are talking about a stage on from meditation. And that first stage encompasses the grounding of negative energies. And in order for a postulant, I can't think of the right word, in order for a person who wants to become enlightened, a sensitive being, to become stronger, the first thing they must do is to have a strong, firm base, a strong foundation. And that means getting in touch with the earth. It means learning how to ground negative energies. And first of all, we learn how to ground those negative energies from ourselves. And that's fine, because we've got an awful lot of stuff hanging around in the lower chakras. The base chakra, the chakra of insecurity, the second chakra, the chakra of painful relationships, the third chakra, anger, jealousy, selfishness, power. It is not enough to learn to meditate. Meditation can be used for good or it can be used for ill. What do you think all of those high financiers are doing when they're dreaming in their dreaming towers of Ilium? When they're dreaming of their next $1 million? They are using meditation to get it. What do you think Einstein was doing when he lay in the bath? He wasn't just playing with his rubber duck. Einstein used to lie in the bath for 8 hours at a stretch, and he came out with the E equals MC squared. The whole world is run on meditation. Meditation can make you tremendously powerful, if used in the wrong way. But the virtue of meditation is that we can purify our energy centers. And when they become purified, then perhaps we can make that first step, that first quantum leap of energy into the heart. The first trans-egotistical chakra. And the only way you're going to get into the heart is by getting away from selfishness, greed, disease, and anything which makes you worry. Because all of that stuff that's hanging around down there is just sheer pain and worry. And if we feel painful and worried, then we become sick. Where that pain and worry grows in the organs for many, many years, so that organ becomes diseased and sick. Only by following the law of the earth, of grounding all of that negativity on a regular daily basis, can we become peaceful, and can we become free of disease, old age, and death, as the Buddha promised. If we learn how to ground negative energies, then we've learned that astral protection is a minor thing in comparison. If we can ground negative energies, then we find that the temporary nature of protecting ourselves with psychic shields is not necessary at all. Remember about the green man and the forces of nature. They cannot be destroyed because they are one with the earth. The Buddha, Gautama Buddha, the Buddha Siddhartha, became enlightened after 5 long years of arduous toil and spiritual practice. He left the palace where he had been born. He left his wife. He left his newborn child. He said, "I must be about my father's business." It's not an easy thing to do. There's a story about a man, and he's eating his food at the table and ignoring his wife's banter and henpeckery. And the wife's saying, "You know, my brother," they do this in India, you know, they sort of into this sort of religious thing. "My brother, he's going to become a sannyasin, he's going to become a monk next week." And the guy's ignoring it, just spooning down his food, you know. He says, "Your brother," he says, "he'll never become a sannyasin. He'll never become a monk. He's too much tied up in the world." And the wife goes, "What do you know about my brother? My brother's a very good man. If he says he's going to do it, he'll do it. Look, if your brother was going to become a monk and he was going to go off and follow a spiritual path, he wouldn't do it next week, because next week never comes. He would do it right now." "What do you know about that? You'd never do that." The man said, "You're right," he said. And at that moment he just stood up and he let his robes drop. And naked, he walked out of the house and walked down the street. And the wife looked at him. He said, "Where are you going?" He says, "I'm going off to become a monk. I'm going to join the Buddha in that grove at the end of the street. I'm going to sit with him every day." "What? You're going? You're going? You're going to leave me? You're going to leave the house and the kids and me? And you're going to go off and follow the Buddha?" He said, "Yes, it's the only way to do it. It's no good dropping your coins one by one into the fountain. You've got to drop them all at once." In the same way as we meditate with the base chakra, we can get rid of that negativity a little bit day by day. But it's best just to drop it all at once. Get rid of it. Now. Here and now. This is why there's two processes of spirituality. The via positiva and the via negativa. That's why there are processes of spirituality. And when the Buddha left his palace, just like that, he didn't just drop everything all at once. No. He spent 5 long years going from master to master, and there was never a more diligent monk or student. He did everything that was asked of him and more. And the master said, look, you've done everything I told you to do, and you are not enlightened. It's no good being with me. You'd better go to that other guru down the road. Perhaps he can help you. And he went from guru to guru, from master to master, for 5 long years, in order to heal himself, in order to become well. And on that path, he found a few people who wanted to travel with him. They thought he was a very advanced soul because he did everything the masters told him to do. He fasted. He didn't eat any food. He meditated. He twisted himself into all sorts of strange yogic postures. And because he was so diligent, these acolytes traveled about with him from master to master, and they thought something of Buddha. They thought he was a good chap. But on the very day before the Buddha became enlightened, he was so sick and he was so weak from his years of privation that he sat down to rest underneath a bow tree. And he just gave up. He said, look, I've done everything. He says, I can't do anything now. I'm just so weak to do anything. And at that moment, a young milkmaid came up. And she said, my lord, you look very weary and sick. Would you like to have this bowl of milk and bread which I have brought for you? And the Buddha was so tired, he thought, sod it. He thought, right, there you go, a bit of bread, a bit of milk, and he felt really great. He felt good. But the acolytes that had been traveling with him, they said, hey, you're supposed to be fasting. We thought you were a good chap. And they all left him. The Buddha just lay down underneath the tree, satisfied for the first time in 5 years. And all of his friends left him. And they went off to join the next guru down the road to try their hand at enlightenment. And it is said that the Buddha gave up everything in that night. He sat up all night in meditation, feeling good for the first time in 5 years. And at the end of that long, starry night, he knew that he was enlightened. And after many years of being enlightened, after many years of talking to multitudes of people and telling them about disease, old age and death, and how to get out of it through being in contact with the earth. Although he didn't quite put it in that way. But all masters teach the same thing. He came once more to the gates of the palace that he had left 10 years previously. And he was an enlightened man, but his brother-in-law, who accompanied him everywhere, was called Ananda, or Bliss. And he had made the Buddha promise that he would take him everywhere with him, to every meeting, because Ananda wanted to follow what the Buddha had said. He wanted to know everything about him. But the Buddha said to Ananda, I'm going in to meet my father and the mother of my son. and it will be a very hard meeting. My Lord, you're not worried by that, are you? You're an enlightened being. No, I'm not worried about me. I feel great compassion for the people that I'm going to meet. So Ananda stayed out of it for once. And Buddha walked into the palace to see his father, and to see his wife, and to see his young son of 10 years of age. And his wife was absolutely, well, you can imagine how she was. She was really angry. She said, "My Lord, I am a warrior's wife. I am the wife of a king. If you had told me that you were going off, I would not have said a thing. But you said nothing to me, or to the young child that was lying in my lap after the exhaustion of childbirth. And all the Buddha could say was, look at me again. I am not the same person that left you 10 long years ago. Now I am different. You must feel my glow. You must feel my energy. I am no longer the poor king who is living in the luxury of this palace. Now, there is no one here. And after she had vented her spleen for a while, she did take pause to look. And she said, yes, there is something about you, there is a glow. There is something about you that is different. And his son was there at the same time. And the son came up to him and he touched the Buddha's feet and he said, I want to become a sannyasin. And the Buddha was very happy to accept the devotion of his own son. And his wife too. I was asked a question last week. How can you try to become enlightened? Because what is enlightenment? Enlightenment is simply having no desires. So it seems a little bit illogical to say, I want to try to become well. I want to try to become fit. Because when you've lost everything, when you have no desires, then you are enlightened. You are well. You are fit. You don't have anything the matter with you. How can you desire to become desireless? If you think of yourself as a dirty cloth, how do you make that dirty cloth become bright and clean? Well, the first thing you do is you dunk it in water. And then you take some more dirt, and we can call it lux or omo, and we can put that dirt in the water and mix it in. And when the dirt on the cloth sees all of its friends playing outside in the water, then the dirt says, oh, look at my little friends out there. Perhaps I can go and join them. And so all the dirt goes out into the water, and at that moment, you pounce on the cloth and you lift it out, and it's bright and clean. The desire to become desireless is the last desire. The desire not to want anything, the desire to have no desires, is that little bit of dirt that you need inside yourself to actually rid yourself of all the dirt. There's a corollary of that story, concomitant corollary. Basically, I asked Swami Satchidananda one day, how do we become purified if we don't have that desire to become desireless, if we don't want to become enlightened, if we don't want to improve ourselves, if we don't want to heal ourselves of what any problems we have? He says it's quite simple. He says, what do you do with gold ore if you want to extract the gold? He says the first thing you do is you take that gold ore and you put it into a furnace at 1000 degrees centigrade and you heat it up till it's glowing. He says, and then you put it on the anvil and you take a big hammer and you beat the shit out of it. That's how you purify that gold ore. And if you do not want to become purified, then you must face the ways of the world. Because if you do the wrong thing, you will learn by your mistake. And this world is like that. If we do the wrong thing, then we have to suffer for that mistake. Unless we can very quickly find out that it was a mistake. All those people who are suffering and in pain, all those people who are getting beaten up, all those people that are getting heated up to high temperatures, are all on the path of enlightenment. And Swami Satchidananda said that this world is a factory for the production of enlightened beings. There's no other purpose to it. So as you look at Bosnia, as you look at all the other 147 countries in the world where torture is used as a means of control, as you look at the unfairness of it all, as you look at the polarization of society into the haves and have-nots, then you've got to ask yourself, what is the purpose of all that? And there are levels within society. And first of all, you join the club of a large religion where basic laws are given. And as you become more evolved, so your groups and your friends' groups become smaller and smaller. Until eventually, you are left in a group of one. And that's when you become enlightened and you can help a few people. Now, what is the nature of raising the energy into the heart? First of all, there's a great healing as we manage to ground and get rid of all that stuff that we're holding inside ourselves. We need to learn how to do that. But the function of an enlightened being, as Sai Baba said, is to remove even the deepest karmas, to get rid of all of that stuff inside. And how does he do that? And there are two ways in which he does it. First of all, there's the energy of pushing, of giving. He gives energy. And as, I'm not just talking about Sai Baba, I'm talking about any enlightened being. I'm talking about Gautama Buddha, I'm talking about Jesus Christ, I'm talking about Muhammad, I'm talking about any enlightened being, and there are thousands of them on this planet. Not just the major ones that start off these big religions. I'm talking about the normal, run-of-the-mill enlightened person. What is their function? And the function seems to be to give energy and to receive negativity. And what happens when a lot of energy is given out to a dirty human being. What happens when the rush of water comes into your cloth? It pushes out all of the dirt into your aura, and people can start to become disturbed by that energy. They feel nervous in its presence. As the dirt comes out into the aura, then people can go to sleep. It's quite normal to find people asleep around the seat of a master. And as they stay there, so all their worst karmas are removed and come out very quickly. The law of healing in homeopathy says that when you're given a homeopathic remedy, then the chances are you will go through all of your childhood diseases from the age you are now, going backwards into your childhood, one by one, very quickly. And there will be a lot of illness in you very quickly, but you'll go through it quickly, and at the other end of that you will become healed. So as you go to see a master, as you go to see somebody that has this energy of positive energy, then all the crap is taken out of your system, and you will go back through your egotistical gains back to the time you were born. And if you can stay there long enough, then you might get what Swami Satchidananda calls an egodectomy. He says, why do people come to this ashram of mine? Why do people come here? He says, these people are the inpatients for the operation of the egodectomy. And you know all these monks out here, the ones in the red garbage, who sit there meditating all day long, who are very high and mighty, those are the people who need me most, because they have the ego of enlightenment, the ego of spirituality, which is also one of the last egos to go. This is one of the reasons why enlightened beings don't hang around in cities. Enlightened beings hie themselves off to the countryside as quickly as possible, because they make trouble. They don't only make people irritable and nervous, they make people downright angry if they are not in the correct state to receive that energy. There's a beautiful story about Bodhidharma going over to China. Bodhidharma was an enlightened being. He came along 300 years after the death of the Buddha, and he was taught by a female guru, whose name is now forgotten. But Bodhidharma was a beautiful soul, and she told him, you must go to China and help that land, because it is in need of your energy. Now, in China at that time, there was an emperor, and China was a very rich land, and the emperor had been converted to Buddhism. He was supporting thousands of monasteries and millions of monks with his treasury. It was a Buddhist land, it was the state religion. And when he heard that an enlightened being by the name of Bodhidharma was coming over to visit him, he took his court, he took his courtiers, he took all the whole entourage, and he headed off for the border to greet Bodhidharma as he entered into the country. And as he was sitting by the border, waiting for Bodhidharma, he saw Bodhidharma striding down from the mountains with his cloak and his staff. Bodhidharma was a rare being, a very fierce being. That was his nature. But when the courtiers saw him walking towards the emperor, and they saw that he was walking with his cloak and his staff, And on top of his head, he'd got one of his shoes. They all started laughing a little bit. And the emperor too was a little bit taken aback. But he had a prepared question for Bodhidharma. Because an unenlightened person is not flowing or spontaneous. An unenlightened being does not have the perfume of the Buddhas, doesn't have the energy of the Buddhas. He is stuck upon an automatic, robotic course, a conveyor belt whose end is death. So as Bodhidharma came towards him, he said, Bodhidharma, may I ask you a question? And Bodhidharma said, yes, my lord. And the king said, I am supporting thousands of monasteries and millions of monks with my treasury. What will be my virtue in heaven? Now what would you say to the emperor if you were there? Would you say, oh my lord, your virtue is so high that you will become enlightened next lifetime and go on to become head of the Buddhist church in China, friend of the emperor and friend to all? No, Bodhidharma didn't do that. He said, nothing. Your virtue in heaven will be nothing. He said, I see that you are not ready for me, my lord. He said, you see that monastery up in the mountain outside your borders? He says, that's where I'm going to be. And he went up to the monastery and he faced the wall alone for 9 years. He sat in meditation facing the wall for 9 years. And it is said that the emperor asked him a second question before he went off to the monastery. And the king said, I have been trying to meditate for years and years, and I have never yet got to that state. Please, can you help me? Bodhidharma said, my lord, come to that monastery at midnight. I will make you into a meditator. And as the emperor stole out of the entourage in the middle of the night, he must have wondered what he was doing, because he never went anywhere without his 7'6" cohorts. But such was the power of the enlightened being of Bodhidharma that he crept away and he went up into the monastery. And he went into the garden, and there he saw Bodhidharma with a cloak and a staff. And Bodhidharma was a very fierce being. There are many pictures of him. And every time you see him, he's got wild eyes. And he looks a bit crazy, looks very fierce. And the emperor thought to himself for the first time, here I am with this guy who I just do not know. And that looks like a very big staff that he's got in his hands. Fear came upon him. But Bodhidharma said, my lord, you want to become a meditator? I want you to sit there and close your eyes, and at any moment I am going to knock your head off. And the emperor was most afraid, but he knew his place. He sat, he closed his eyes, he controlled his breathing deep into the abdomen, and he concentrated like he had never concentrated before in his life. And of course Bodhidharma was just sitting there with him. And at the end of that evening, as the dawn rose, as the sun rose in the sky, the emperor opened his eyes and he said, oh, that was the shortest meditation I've ever had in my life. And it was the best. I finally got to that state of no mind. Bodhidharma said goodbye to the emperor, and he went back to his entourage and to his meditation, and he stayed in the monastery facing the wall for 9 years. Because if he had gone into the city with the emperor, he would have spoken the truth. And if he had spoken the truth, then he would have been killed, because the courtiers and the emperor could not stand the truth. As a matter of fact, the whole country of China was built upon deceit. And the deceit is always half a truth. It's being parsimonious with the truth. And the reason that we become parsimonious with the truth, the only reason we do it is because we want to deceive. And the whole of this world is built upon that deceit. And you can see it now in action. It hasn't changed very much. This positive energy from a master tends to make all personality flaws immediately visible. And if the person who comes is not in the right state of receiving, of being able to receive, of having the energy to be able to receive, then they might not like what they see. Because Hermes Trismegistus says, as within, so without. As you have inside, so your worst faults are inside, so you will see them projected outside. And many is the person that comes to Satya Sai Baba and says, whoa, what an egotistical git that guy is. Not remembering that there's three fingers pointing backwards. So when Jesus goes on his ass into Jerusalem, he knows exactly what he is doing. And he knows that the people are going to be pointing the finger at him. He knows that he is going to be nailed up simply by going into the city. If he'd stayed out in the desert for another 40 days and nights, there would have been no problem. But always the masses project their neuroses and their problems upon other people who they're looking at. So if you come close to a master, you must be prepared for that reaction. You must always be aware that the master helps you to find your worst faults. And then, after having found them, he has the energy of receiving. And all of your worst faults, after they have come out, he absorbs and he grounds and he digests and he goes, yum yum, where's the second course? Because he is not affected by the energies of others. He does not gather the energies of others into himself and becomes more sick. If he was there in the middle of a plague, he would not become sick. As the plague spreads out over the people, as flu spreads out over the people, as the miasm of negative energy spreads out over the people, he is there eating it up, purifying society. So usually it's only a few people that go to see a real master. Because the masses will go to the cities and to the courts. They will join the big organizations where their flaws are less visible. To actually come into the presence of a lot of positive energy takes a lot of courage. Because everything is laid bare. And it takes real humility to understand that you are as yet not enlightened, that you are not perfect, that you have a few little flaws here and there. And that's not a bad thing, actually, because there's a beautiful Soto Zen phrase that says, 80% is perfection. 80% is perfection. And you are 80% perfect. You've been through a great deal. You have purified yourself tremendously. But there's still that little bit at the top that needs to be acknowledged more than anything else. And you should say thank you very much to anybody that points out your faults. Not to accept that you have that particular fault, because that person might be pointing his finger at his own chimera as well. But you must say, yes, perhaps I have that fault. I will look into it. And remember, if you're in the heart, you won't be angry. Many big, strong men that are emotionally very weak. You say something to a big, strong man, and he'll come over and knock your block off. But emotionally, very weak. So it takes a lot of evolution to be able to take that sort of thing. Stop there. I was going to go on. I've chucked a little bit out of the talk as I saw it. But I think it'd be nice to really finish up with a nice chant again. So this time we're going to chant, not Hari Om, we're going to chant Om Shanti. Again, A, U and M. A at the base chakra, U into the heart, M into the forehead, crown of the head, upwards into the center of the universe. And Shanti means peace. So sit up straight, and let's have some meditation.
Om Shanti, Om Shanti, Om Shanti. Om Shanti, Om.
Shanti Om Shanti.
Sean.